Hey, this is Ross and Richard from Haken, and you're listening to the 9-8 Podcast.
To the 9-8 Podcast, the home of progressive and underground music right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and every fortnight I'm joined by Dave Ellis. Hello, Dave.
G'day, g'day. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's the first fine day in about 3 days here, so it's fantastic.
That's excellent. It's actually, it's nice and sunny here, but it's starting to cool off, which is, yesterday was really humid, as Sydney was warranted to be.
Humid in April. Goodness.
Yeah. That thing that doesn't exist, you know, global warming.
Wow, at least not for the Liberal Party. Hey-oh! Right. Now, there's the politics bit out of the way. So we'll jump straight into some follow-up. And we had, last time on the show, we mentioned that King Crimson were finally getting in on the streaming game. They're going to be putting all their music on Spotify. We didn't, at the time of recording, have a date for that. We do now. It will be they will go live on June the 10th, 2019.
Excellent. So everyone can go back and listen to all of the King Crimson stuff without having to find a vinyl player and or CDs and or deal with JB Hi-Fi.
Yes.
Which ridiculously, I was about to say, and you had a bit of an issue with JB / Amazon and all that during the week, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I would like to register a complaint with Amazon. Why the fuck can I not buy MP3s on Amazon?
Yeah, doesn't make
apparently
any sense.
Apparently this has been a thing for a long time. I personally haven't used Amazon in forever, but I thought, oh, I want to buy the Jordan Rudess album without having to wait 6 weeks for it to show up because my local JB Hi-Fi is rubbish and doesn't have a copy. So I thought, oh, I'll just jump on Amazon and buy the MP3. Nope, can't be done in this country.
Of course not. It's the same reason why we have this wonderful thing called the internet, but we can't buy anything from the United States. As you know, Hoggy, and as some of the listeners probably know if they've met us and or heard us talk about this before, I actually have a mailbox over in the US. So if I want to buy anything, I always just buy it from Guitar Center or something like that and get it shipped across. Because by the time you do all that, it's cheaper. And B, there's a way bigger selection available. Like there's stuff here, this strings that I use on some of my guitars are what's called classic rock and rolls, which are pure nickel. They were available in Australia for about a year and they just weren't selling. So they stopped bringing them in, but you can still get them in the States, no problems at all.
The economics of having a few thousand guitar players as opposed to like a few million, I assume, in America.
Oh, more than likely, yeah. I think that's probably pretty accurate. But it's still annoying. Like even if I want to order them in this country, like they just look at me like I've got two heads.
Ugh.
Which is the really stupid thing because you'd expect them to go, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, man. I'll get them in for you, you know, but not for $23 a set. Thanks very much. It's supposed to be about five.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, it is what it is.
It is.
I mean, this is just the nature of being a muso, especially in a country that doesn't pay particularly well and in industry that doesn't pay particularly well. And there was something about, Amanda Palmer?
This was years ago. Where she decided that she wasn't going to pay her, she was going to pay her touring musicians in quote pizza and hugs, and got bombed with comments from lots of people saying how awful that was. And this was not long after she'd made $1 million on a Kickstarter, so it was like this idea. It was, you know, the big snappy headline, you know, millionaire Kickstarter campaign, and you know, not going to pay her musicians, and she like, 5 days later, got shamed into basically paying everyone.
Why do people have to get shamed into doing it?
This is a whole other topic.
Well, it's like that saying, you know, that the guy calls up five musos and says, "Mate, Saturday night I've got a wedding. How much are you gonna charge?" And they say, "Oh, it's probably about, you know, $2,000 for the night." And he goes, $2,000? What for music?" So the guy says, "Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you call the plumbers union? Get five plumbers to come out on Saturday night to try and fix something, and whatever they'll work for 5 hours, we'll do it for half." You know, and that's that's really the whole point of this entire thing. And in actual fact, I mean, what we were talking, we'll get onto this a little bit later, but there was a thing with Misha Mansour recently, some people probably saw on Facebook, about the economics of making music. And we'll come to that in due course. But you've also got something in here about Rachel Wilsey.
Rachel is the manager of a English prog band, Pendragon. They've got an album coming out later on this year, which we may come to some other time. Mm-hmm. And she posted on Facebook about how she was negotiating with a promoter for a gig. Mm-hmm. And the promoter asked her what money they would need for the gig. And she said, well, you know, a tour bus costs this much and we've got to pay the crew and pay the session musicians, da da da. So we want X pounds. Mm-hmm. The response from the promoter was, oh no, that's way too much money. Why don't you make the session musicians part of the band so you don't have to pay them and it'll be cheaper? To which she basically headbutted the keyboard.
Hey, there's a table sitting in front of me. I'm considering flipping it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, this is the idea. It's like, oh yeah, why don't you just not pay people? That's an idea you could do. You could just not pay people, and that's a solution.
How about
you
just do your fucking job and pay us? We're doing a job. We get paid the same way that you do a job.
Touring is expensive. And especially if you want to put on the sort of show that people want to put on, they want to have, you know, decent sound and they want to have their instruments and all their, you know, pedals and effects and whatnot.
And you're going to need something to put it in. The punters want to go and see decent musos too.
Yes. They're not going to, like, you're not going to rock up and pay £20 to watch, like, a, you know, something that could be done at a pub, you know.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's just
yeah. Which is why I saw that and I immediately thought of Amanda Palmer, who attempted to pay her session musicians in pizza and beer, and boy, did that not work out well for her.
Typical. Yeah. I mean, this is just anyway.
Yet more depressing instances of the economics of touring.
Absolutely. Following up on that, we've got what I briefly mentioned earlier, which is Misha Mansour. Now, for those of you who didn't see it during the week, Misha Mansour, who is one of the guitarists from Periphery, he had a big interview with Ola Englund, who you probably know is a YouTube celebrity slash the guitarist from Haunted or The Haunted. I can't remember if it's Haunted or The Haunted. And really cool guy. And he does a series called Coffees with Ola, and he interviews a whole bunch of different musos. He's done, you know, Tosin Abasi, and who, by the way, actually mentioned a good friend of mine, Stephen Taranto, who I've been trying desperately to get on this show. And he said that he would come on the show and he just hasn't come on the show yet, and I'm really annoyed because I want to chase him to do it.
Don't worry, Dave. There's plenty of time to chase musicians for interviews.
I know. But yeah, he got one with Misha Mansour, and Misha Mansour was actually talking about the economics of touring, which we've dabbled in a little bit on this show. And then the shit hit the fan. Because undoubtedly how some of you probably saw it, if you did see it, was when Ultimate Guitar basically took quotes from the interview and put it as a text interview on their site and said this is what they said, which is the same thing that Blabbermouth had been doing for years with the Portnoy stuff.
They're not the only ones as well. I mean, even Louder Sound and Consequent, they're all guilty of doing this. They'll go, oh, so-and-so. Like, we spoke last time about Stephen Wilson's sniffy comments about Greta Van Fleet. That was nicked from a podcast.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I mean, with attribution, of course, but Ultimate Guitar did it in the worst way possible. It's like they put it in teeny-tiny font at the top of the article. It's like, oh, here's this thing from Ola Englund, and I really had to search for it to find it because the only way I found out about it was Misha Mansour himself in the damn comments on the thread saying, basically, fuck you, this is why I don't give you interviews, because you just steal shit straight up from everybody else.
Exactly. I think the thing that was really funny about it was Misha in there who basically said, don't steal my interviews just because I won't give you one. It's like, oh, shots fired.
Yeah. Obviously, they've got a bit of a rap within the game for being, like, just the worst kind of grubby link aggregator types.
Well, Ultimate Guitar used to be really cool, right? It used to have all the tabs and it was a community source tab thing. So you could jump on there and you could pretty well learn any song you wanted. I remember that's how I learned Dream Theater's As I Am, was from tabs from from there. And then later on, they did like guitar profiles and all that sort of stuff. So people had, you know, done all the backing tracks and everything like that. So you could drop it into Guitar Pro and you could actually, you know, practice and everything like that. Really
presumably,
cool system.
Presumably the reason they don't do that anymore is because of like huge copyright issues.
They're still doing it. It's just not the main part of their site okay. now. They've kind of turned into this news site. You know, I'm talking back in the bad days of the internet when it was all forums and, you know, the John Petrucci forum was a thing and Seven String forum was a thing and all that sort of stuff. So we're going back to, 2004 maybe?
Pre-Facebook days, effectively.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Pre-Facebook, yeah. It's like forums and mailing lists before social media and existed.
Exactly, yeah. But in this interview, Misha said, you know, I think one of the fundamental differences between my point of view and a lot of other people is that people would have called me a cynical asshole because they said, you know, this CD thing can't last forever. It's going to come around. There's going to be a change. And I said, yeah, there's going to be a change. It's going to suck for artists. And that's exactly what we've seen. And he's 100% right. 100% oh, yeah. right. In that the... Well, there was actually another really interesting video, and I'll see if I can find it and put it in the show notes, where this guy was talking about why you shouldn't be making albums. You shouldn't be making EPs. You should be making singles. And if you really want to make albums and all that sort of stuff, that's totally fine. But let's be honest, it's not to sell. It's for your own self-gratification.
I'm not so sure about that.
No, in today's day and age, I actually firmly agree with that. And
it depends on what sort of music you're making, though. I mean... Weird Al Yankovic has been quite open recently about and saying, I'm not doing albums anymore because the album doesn't make sense for him because he's doing parodies. The parody, like within six, you know, in 6 months' time, when it takes, however long it takes him to get a record together, the popular thing is gone. So when he wanted to do the rip off of that god awful Pharrell Williams song, Happy.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, he could do that almost immediately. He'd come up with the lyrics and do the thing, da da da, and you know, get permission from people and bang and put it out.
Yeah.
You could do that very quickly when you're doing singles. If your music sort of lends itself to the more sort of art, you know, having big art books and a storyline and all that sort of thing, I think the album still makes sense.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. But let's be honest, and I think we've said this before, I feel that the album now, album EP, et cetera, is really just a tool to get people to your show.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I think it's fairly obvious that no one actually makes money out of selling music anymore. You might be able to make some money out of selling merchandise or, you know, fancy editions or whatever.
Yep.
But standard
VIP tickets.
We'll just skip straight past that one. You know, or even just concerts in general. I mean, did you see how much Queen were charging for a ticket?
No, I didn't actually look, to be honest with you. I'm going to guess 200 a ticket.
Yeah, and that's for the shit seats right at the back.
Yeah.
Because they're playing here in Perth. They're playing at Optus Stadium, which is the new big craypot thing they spent $2 billion putting together.
Yes, yeah.
The government spent $2 billion and didn't ask the football clubs for a single fucking dime. We're getting off topic.
Yep.
But, yeah, and apparently it sounds absolutely awful. The sound in that particular venue is terrible.
Well, what do you expect?
Yeah, I know. It's a fucking football stadium, not a concert arena.
Exactly. I mean, I'll be honest, I've been to ANZ Stadium to see a couple of people, and ANZ Stadium in Sydney is, for those of you that don't know, it's the big fuck-off one. ANZ Stadium sounds amazing. Yeah, I saw U2 there. I've seen...
You bastard. I'm just going to put that on record. You bastard? You actually saw U2?
Mate, I was on the railing.
How much did that cost you?
$90.
Really?
Yep, because so U2
charge $1 million for their tickets. They're like Guns N' Roses level.
No. What they did is they actually did something really smart. So this was the 360 tour, right? And they had the center stage, and then they had these revolving bridges that like flew around, and then on the outside of that they had like an outer ring, right? So you had the inner ring, which is where like the first 500 people who rocked up to the show could get into. Then you had the outer ring. It was the same price for the general admission ticket for that.
Oh, okay. You're just rewarding people who like sleeping in a sleeping bag outside the arena for 2 days.
Basically, yeah. Then you had Then you had the red section, I think they called it, which is like Bono's charity thing that goes and helps the starving children and does all that sort of stuff. And then you had all the seating. The seating, a friend of mine went on the same night that I did. The seating cost her, I think, $160 a ticket. And it was obviously the seating, which is not near the stadium.
Yeah, a thousand miles away and being played at you through a tannoy.
Exactly. But I was literally on the railing in the inner ring. That's where I wound up because a mate of mine got there early and saved me a spot. And they actually, I arrived and they came and gave us numbers. And I was number 423 or something like that. He was 424.
I've seen this before where they give people numbers in queues. It's a good system.
Yep. It's a really good system. It's like, well, you're here, so, you know.
Yeah.
But that's actually
you
really come, good.
You turn up, you get your number, and then, okay, oh, if you need to nip off and grab a bite to eat or go to the loo or whatever, you can come back and get your queue spot.
Exactly. But that's actually a really good sounding stadium, right? But on the whole, stadiums and very large venues and things like that, unless they're designed specifically for entertainment, they're going to sound like dick, right?
Yep.
And a new sports ball thing is not designed for that. It's designed for some guy going, oh, that was a marvellous kick. Yes, and right
got
now
him, yes,
we've
piss
got,
off,
yes,
you're
got
out.
Him, and yes, that is a try. Oh, we're going to the video ref. You know, it's not designed to have complex audio
oh,
sequences.
Dave, that was the opportunity for a
through.
Birmingham bit.
So, yeah, so back on like ticket pricing and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's really hard for people to make money in music now. Right, even selling merch and all that. I was speaking to Randall from Red Gazelle the other day. He came to I actually sold him some bits and bobs from my old apartment, and he came and picked them up, and we were yakking about because they're doing very well. They've had shows with Trapped and a whole bunch of US artists that have come over and everything. And he said, you know, it's a real money sink because every show you have to sink $500, $600, $700, $800 into merch. Because you have to have merch there. It's
oh,
part
as
of
in
the
like
stipulation.
Actual having stuff to sell.
Yes.
Having t-shirts, having records available, yeah, records yeah. pressed, et cetera.
Exactly. You have to have that stuff there. It's a stipulation in contract.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was so, like you have to have stuff there because you need to, like, make money.
No, it's a stipulation of the contract.
Oh,
of the support
oh okay.
Act.
That's interesting.
So you
that's
have
really
to spend,
interesting.
You have to spend this money, right?
Then yeah, you've got to get t-shirts that. Printed. You've got to have CDs in a box to sell and all the rest of it.
Exactly. And then you've got to recoup that, especially if it's one show, you're just doing the Sydney show, right? You might be getting paid $300 or $400, maybe $500 for the appearance, right? Appearance money, essentially. You play your set. You'd be real hard-pressed to do $300 of merch sales if you're not the headlining band.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a money sink until you get to the point where you can actually go over to Europe, and we've talked about this before on the show, Europe, Japan, the United States, etc. People are just more well received, particularly again in Sydney than those in Sydney.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say as well, it'd be hard to do merch because as I think we've discussed before, getting people to actually turn up for the opening band, that's a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, we've got this thing, particularly in Australia, but particularly in Sydney. If
I wouldn't say this is necessarily a Sydney thing. I think it's just an Australia-wide thing. It's like people only care about the headliner and don't give a fig about the opening band.
Yeah, and I think that's mostly because it's a status thing.
Mm.
You know, oh, I went and saw Metallica last night. I went and saw Slipknot. I went and saw Stephen Wilson. You know, very rarely do people say, oh, yeah, man, I went and saw this really cool band. They were called Mojo Juju, right?
Yeah.
It was really cool. And people talk about it around the water cooler. That doesn't happen anymore.
Certainly doesn't help when certain big name prog bands, looking at you, Stephen Wilson, and looking at you, Dream Theater, don't actually have opening bands anymore. That doesn't help.
I kind of don't mind that because Stephen Wilson's a little bit different because the songs are generally a little bit shorter. They could probably do that. Dream Theater and Tool, for example, I would rather see 3.5 hours of Dream Theater for $160 a ticket than Dream Theater plus a support act. Because I remember the second time I think they came to Australia, they had
Pain of Salvation.
Pain of Salvation supporting them. Pain of Salvation were cool, but, you know, like it is a very specific thing. And that's one of the things with a lot of prog is unless you're going to get a little you know, a little Dream Theater to support Dream Theater.
Yeah, or who
a
little wants that? Tool. Who wants that, really?
Well, I think that's the nature of it, unfortunately, particularly with those specific bands where you've got, you know, John Fogerty, for example, coming out. Yeah, okay, you get a local guy who's kind of rock and it'll, you know, it'll work, the Lockharts or the, oh, they're not around anymore, but Fangs or someone like that to support, and that'd be really cool. But particularly in prog, yeah, I would rather see a full show of that without them supporting, or I'd like to see them do a dual or triple headliner. So have, for example, Dream Theater and I don't know, someone.
Dream Theater, what, like sort of Dream Theater, Haken and Periphery, for example?
Yeah, something like that. So Dream Theater and Haken, and then maybe
That would be hilariously expensive to put on. Kind of cool. If you had, pretty damn expensive.
Well, if you had Dream Theater and Haken, for example, and then you had a local band as well supporting, I reckon that'd actually be a really, really cool thing. But here in Australia, it's pretty unlikely that people will actually do support acts anyway, particularly international artists, because it's just so far to come and it's already costing them so much money.
Yeah.
And then not to mention as well, you ever tried to apply for being to be a support act?
Yes, like I've seen the comments underneath the Butterfly Effect. You've got probably 100-150 bands trying to be the opening slot,
and that's a local band.
Yeah, right?
Like I know people reasonably high up in the music industry, and I have pulled out every stop for my band to try and get a support, and so far we've got no major international supports. Despite me knowing, I know managers, like I know the guys who brought Nickelback out. Right? I rang them and said, dude, we'd love to play this. And they went, yeah, okay, send us your stuff. I pestered them and 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 got nothing. And I know the guy.
Probably because they're being bombed with like several hundred other bands.
Yeah, I get that. I understand that. I understand what, that's what I'm saying.
And it's, I also reckon as well, I mean, I spoke about this with David Anderton of Chaos Divine. They tend to look at the social media stats as well.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
They look at view counts. They look at monthly listeners. They look at that kind of stuff
these
days. Not only
monthly listeners and view counts, but they also look at the reactions you're getting, right? Mm. So where you've got, if you've got, say, for example, a band where you've got three, say you've got a five-piece band or a four-piece band, let's make the numbers easy, and you've got three people that are pushing it really hard, but let's say the lead singer is the most connected of the lot of them, and he's not posting anything. He's not doing, he or she is not doing anything to actually actively do that. That reflects poorly on the band because they're not getting the love hearts on the posts. They're not getting the likes. They're not getting the emoji reactions and all that sort of stuff. And I know it sounds really simplistic and almost childish, but that's what they're looking at. And that's really, really hard to come back from.
I'd also argue that there's no point looking at Twitter because at least from, I mean, people who follow us on Twitter will have noticed that Twitter is like just a empty void you yell into.
Basically, yeah.
There is almost no interaction.
No, there's not. It's an essential tool for journalists, and that's about it.
Yeah, journalists, Donald Trump, and Twitter itself.
Yes.
Those are the three winners in Twitter, nobody else.
So, so after all that, we should probably move on to some news.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we've done enough follow-up.
So now it's time for the news.
So the first item that we have on news is the Frank Zappa hologram tour. That has kicked off a couple of days ago in America. Now, for those of you who are not aware, this is essentially a Frank Zappa backing band with Frank Zappa as a holographic projection on the screen. I heard you sigh while I was reading that bit out, Dave. What do you think of this?
I'm kind of surprised they haven't done this with Freddie Mercury, to be really honest with you.
They do that. Yeah, he does appear for like one song, I think, with Queen on a backdrop. But it's one song. It's not the whole damn gig. And you have an actual lead singer at the front.
I'm excited for the technological advance that allows this to happen. I, however, am really pissed off because it's not right. It's just weird. Like, Frank Zappa's dead. Let's let him be dead rather than essentially digging up his corpse and letting it parade around on stage as a hologram. It's just weird. At what point do we actually divide technology and artists and the ability? Like, basically, I'm just waiting for the day that we're all just, you know, you can just buy a concert. I mean, well, we can already do it with DVDs somewhat, but you can buy a concert ticket and you just put goggles on and you just watch it from the comfort of your lounge room, and there's the band in LA or something, and they don't even have to move from their comfort, you know?
Okay. First of all, that would be awesome. I would totally pay that.
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't? Why not?
No way. Because you lose the environment. You lose the atmosphere. The band loses the atmosphere.
Depends how it, well, if it's, okay, if it's like an actual gig in an actual place with people there and you just happen to be like a remote attendee, that would be kind of cool.
Okay, I agree with you
like
on
a,
that.
If it's like a band on a soundstage, yeah, that'd be kind of lame.
That's what I'm saying. I reckon it'd be bands on soundstages because it's a slippery slope. Once you start doing this stuff, right, it becomes a slippery slope. At what point do we say, no, enough is enough? Like this holographic technology, I'm sorry, is just weird and creepy and I don't like it. And yes, that's because it's threatening a part of my income and it's threatening a part of my life. And I get that, and it makes me sound like Holden Caulfield who doesn't want change. But it's still just weird. And I'm not for this whole hologram thing. It's just
I'm
odd.
Not for this either, but for entirely different reasons.
Which are?
This particular tour is backed by the Zappa Family Trust. Now, I think we've spoken on the show before about the battle between Dweezil Zappa and his own brother, Ahmet, mm-hmm. who is in control of the Zappa Family Trust.
Mm-hmm.
This tour is backed by Ahmet.
Right.
And he was the one who put the kibosh and put a cease and desist order out on his own fucking brother to stop him using the Frank Zappa name in touring around with his own music. So Dweezil Zappa's been touring around for God knows how long with Zappa Plays Zappa.
Yeah.
He has his band and I've seen Dweezil Zappa play live. It is a fantastic live show. Next time he comes around to Australia, I urge everybody to buy a damn ticket because it is fantastic.
It is a good show.
I'm not a particularly big Frank Zappa music fan, but if you are, I said the same thing about like King Crimson. If you're a fan of music, you'll enjoy the show. You may not necessarily be a devotee of the music necessarily, but it's a fantastic show and it's full of fantastic musicians. So this is the problem I have with this holographic tour is that Ahmet can put a cease and desist notice out against his own brother to prevent him from playing his father's music without paying the family trust, and then he can go and wheel out a hologram and do it himself. That is the icky part for me.
Yeah.
You don't like it from a technological standpoint of like, you know, oh, this is like the death of touring. I don't like it because Ahmet's a cunt who did it to his own brother.
Yeah, well, that too. you know, I just, and this is again, I suppose a little bit of the socialist coming out in me. And that is, then who gets the money from this? So in this case, it's
the family trust gets the money, but the family trust itself is millions and millions of dollars in debt. Dweezil Zappa is only a beneficiary of the family trust once it's in profit. So Ahmet and his sister, Diva, get to make a fantastic amount of money off this whole thing, and the family trust is in debt. And Dweezil and his sister, Moon Unit, yes, that really is her name, get jack crap.
Moon Unit.
Yeah. Dweezil's kind of funny too, but yeah, whatever.
Okay, yeah, Dweezil's kind of a bit weird, but Moon Unit, I mean, come on, that's just too good. My big concern is what happens a little bit later on. So when you have, for example, let's say John Fogerty, right? Let's talk about Creedence Clearwater Revival. Creedence Clearwater Revival basically owned by Fantasy Records, right? Let's say they did a hologram of Creedence Clearwater Revival. So the four of them, you know, Stu Cook, Doug Clifford, Tom Fogerty and John Fogerty, right? And they did the whole thing and they did all the original Creedence songs and all that sort of stuff. Who gets the money?
That's a good question.
See my issue? So yeah. Then you've got artists, and don't get me wrong, I don't think John needs more money, right? I mean, the guy lives in a private estate in 90210, but in California.
It's got to be California.
just out of LA. I've been there. I have driven to his estate and got turned around by a security guard. You know, like
like that should be a great surprise.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that's exactly what it's like. He lives, you know, with the rich and the famous. He doesn't need more cash, all right? But that's irrelevant. The point is then he's going to have his money stolen from him and given to a record company, right? Yeah. These are the same pricks who are not paying artists properly. These are the same pricks who sued him. Yeah, exactly. The same bastards that sued him as well, right? And how many other artists are like that? How many great blues songs? You know, B.B. King. Like, what are we going to do? Have a holographic projection of B.B. King, and then the money's going to go to where?
That's my issue with it. Well, I was going to just this is not the Frank Zappa and the Zappa family are by no means the first people to do this.
No, not at all.
Roy Orbison has been wheeled out as a holographic thing, mm-hmm. and Ronnie James Dio has also been wheeled out as a holographic thing by the Ronnie James Dio family.
So it's Tupac, I think, from memory, and I don't know, insert other dead rapper here. Like, there's a stack of them that have done it, but it's just, sorry. You're not going to get me with that.
It's the nostalgia thing. Everybody loves nostalgia.
Oh, yeah, member berries, you know, but
yeah.
Just, no thanks.
Anyway.
Moving on, and speaking of touring, Devin Townsend. Tour plans.
Devin Townsend
said on his Twitter, which again was people yelling into the void, but here we are, two journalists who have used it for something. He said, "I've been auditioning people I've had my eye on for upcoming tours. Basically, my plan is to do different tours with different bands over the next few years, each specializing in different styles in different territories, then ending with a handful of Empath in full shows in 2021. So
Him would be this. If one of those Empath in full shows is not at the Plovdiv Amphitheatre in Bulgaria, you have failed as a musician.
Yes. And if some of these shows are not in Australia, I'm going to come over there and strangle you.
Well, this is the point. This is what I was getting to. He says he's going to do different tours with different bands in different regions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we in Australia are going to get?
Tour
here because he's toured here before and relatively successfully. He came here with the last record, Transcendence. So what do you think we're going to get?
We're going to get whatever there's the back end of Asia. We know this.
No. But in terms of the style, what style are we going to get?
I think we're going to get the heavier side of things.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking we're going to get pretty much the same that we got on the last tour.
Yeah.
A four-piece, you know, maybe there'll be some backing tracks. Maybe they'll be playing stuff off a laptop through the PA, that sort of thing. But I think we're going to get mostly the heavier stuff.
Yeah, I
can
agree.
See in Europe them doing more of like a theatre sort of thing,
uh-huh.
where yeah, it's like a theatre thing, and you could do it the more sort of classically inspired elements of the record.
Yes.
In America, they could probably do a mix of both, frankly. So that's my theory. I reckon we're going to get it's going to be like a club tour, and it's going to be the heavy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. But we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And our final bit of news for today is Dream Theater. Now,
yes.
Some of you guys, we would be amiss if we did not talk about Dream Theater at least 50% of the time on this podcast. And some of you know that the Dream Theater fan club here in Australia and New Zealand we posted that they will be coming back to Australia soon. We've heard rumors that it's probably going to be around September time.
Now, how did you find out about this, Dave?
Which, the September time or?
I'm putting the ball on the tee here for you, Dave. How did you find out about the thing?
Some of you know Jordan Rudest often does live things where he's playing a piano and he answers some questions and such. And at the moment, he's kind of in full swing with his new album, which we're going to be talking about today. But I asked him a question. I had to ask him.
Contractually obligated as an Australian Dream Theater fan, of course.
Yes.
If you have any interactions with the band, you have to ask them when they're coming to Australia.
That's right. Now, the first time I asked him this, he said, yes, we are definitely going to be coming back. And that was the post that we put on the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand site. Breaking news, bang, they will be coming back at some point, probably this year. However, he had a second one. And my question was a little bit more pointed this time. My question was, are you going to be bringing the Scenes from a Memory tour? The full tour to Australia. And his answer was, yes, absolutely. So we will be getting in Australia the entire Scenes from a Memory cover to cover here in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, I would assume, or Sydney and Melbourne, or a combination of those.
I was going to say even Brisbane, I think, is probably a bit of optimism. I think it's probably just Sydney and Melbourne again, I would have thought.
I'm not sure, because I think the band are pushing to get to the other cities this time.
Yeah, they can push for it, but I don't think they're going to get it.
Well, you never know. I mean, Haken are doing Adelaide, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney.
And Auckland, I believe.
And Auckland, that's correct.
Yep.
So there's your Dream Theatre news for this fortnight. We will always obviously keep you up to date with everything that's going on there. And the second that we know anything, you guys will... Well, the second that we can say anything, we will say it.
Some stuff is put under embargo for obvious reasons.
Yes, exactly. And it happens quite a lot. So there's your hint. So that's all I think we've got for the news. But as always, the 9-8 podcast brings you some great interviews, and this week is no different. So here's our interview segment with the boys from Haken. Well, Haken are one of the greatest progressive rock, progressive metal acts around at the moment, hailing from the United Kingdom, and it is with great pleasure that I get to say that they are on the show and on the line with me right now. The lead singer, Ross, and the keyboardist, Richard, are joining me all the way from England here on the 9-8 podcast. Guys, thank you so much for joining me.
No problems.
First and foremost, thanks for joining me on the show. It's an honour to interview you guys. I saw you guys with Mike Portnoy, actually, a couple of years ago when he did the Shattered Fortress show here in Australia, and I got to say I was absolutely blown away.
Yeah, that was a great time for us, actually, like a career highlight. We enjoyed that so much. What an honour to be selected as Mike's band, and to play music from a band which we grew up listening to, massive influences on us. It was such a killer time.
We toured the whole world with that show, and I'm pretty sure we ended up in Australia. So the last show was in Australia. Was it in Melbourne? No, Brisbane.
I think Brisbane was the final one.
I think it's the final show. But yeah, so that kind of made it even more memorable for us to end up over there.
Absolutely. And it was great. And one of the things that I've sort of been talking to the other host of the 9-8, Hoggy, about for the last little while is we've often wondered how much that experience, actually travelling with Mike and playing the show for over a year almost, I think it was, how much did that actually influence your new album, Vector, which, by the way, I have to say, is an absolute killer album as well?
Thank you so much. I mean, it was a massive learning curve for us when we went out there with Mike, and it was a huge inspiration. He was in control of so many different aspects of the whole show. So when people came into the venue, there would be music playing from like old demos from back in the day, from the early days of Dream Theater. Mm-hmm. And on the merch desk, he had a lot of themed items, which helped tie everything together. So we've kind of taken that on board, and we've tried to make it a fully immersive experience for people when they come into the show. We tried to step up our stage show by adding some lights, some program lights to the whole stage. And generally, they're the main things that we've taken from that tour, at least that's what I took from it.
This is Ross speaking now. I recall us actually starting to write Vector whilst we were doing those shows in Australia in hotel rooms. I think Good Doctor and Cell Divides, I think, were possibly one of the first.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was Hotel.
The first tunes we started penciling when we were out there. So perhaps, and maybe subconsciously, there was some kind of influence from those songs coming through. For sure.
Now you guys are playing a few shows around Australia in June, I believe it is. You'll be on our shores here, and one in New Zealand as well, which will be absolutely fantastic for all the Kiwi fans.
Right.
Now, this time around, you've swapped out Perth for Adelaide, which is something that I'm sure the Adelaidean fans will be very happy about. But I have to ask, why is it that you aren't hitting all the major cities? Is this an economics of touring sort of striking in here?
Yeah, I mean, the logistics of touring are kind of not really in our powers as musicians. We kind of leave it to the booking agents and the promoters out there. So at the end of the day, we kind of go with what's been decided. And I guess when it comes to the crunch, it is down to the financials and what's possible in the time frame we have. There's no no hard feelings towards any particular city or anything like that. We'd love to do more. We'd love to do them all. But I think for this this current time, this is what we were able to pull off.
For sure. For sure. Now, with you're speaking of you know, economics and sort of what's on, I suppose what's in the kitty. Playing in a band myself, I understand the idea of having a band account and all that sort of stuff. You guys were actually well around before streaming services, and you know, basically people essentially wanting music for free. How much has the rise of these streaming services actually impacted on the bottom line for you guys? Is it more a case of you using the albums and stuff to get people to the shows so that they'll get merch and support the band that way? Or how has the reaction actually been to Vector? Have you guys sold more copies, I suppose hard copies, than what you've had streams?
I mean, I feel like we have such a large, the fan base ranges from the young kids up to the older generations, and I feel like there's certain sections of the audience will go out and buy vinyl, and I don't feel like our sales have suffered too much in the scheme of things. But there is a lot of streaming is obviously prominent in the business now, and although we don't see a lot of royalties from that stuff, we do rely on that kind of thing for the word to be spread. And that, in result of that, you know, we see more people coming to our shows and buying our merch. So yeah, we, business wise, we do rely a lot on the shows and the touring and the merch. It's a very important part of it. I feel like the kind of music we are putting out there, like I said, does attract a vast age range, and yeah, it's not suffering too much, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And is it something that you've seen, you guys have seen, obviously the prog scene, at least in Australia, seems to be growing quite substantially. You know, we've got Progfest over here now, which was its 10th year this year. I don't know if you guys have heard of that, but it's a big festival that we have.
You know, Sky Harbor there recently, and I've heard of that festival.
Yeah, that was this year. Sky Harbor were there this year, and it was a fantastic day. And obviously there's been a rise of progressive bands across Australia, you know, Voyager and Caligula's Horse and you know, big ones, Carnival and Cog, etc., who were just recently over your way, actually. So how do you feel that prog music is actually going? Do you think it's on the up and up? Do you think it's sort of, there's a lot of things that I hear, obviously being a part of this podcast and being one of the heads of the Dream Theatre Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand as well. We hear, you know, rock is dead and, you know, it's all sort of fragmented now, and you've got prog rock and prog metal and all this sort of stuff. Do you think progressive music is actually taking off, and where will it go?
Yeah, I've always regarded progressive music as music that's really appreciated by musicians. So I don't know how far it can really go in terms of mainstream. I am, like, you know, it's warming to us that a lot more people are listening to it now, and it's, I think maybe perhaps the internet has played a massive part in that. We're getting heard more and more. I think when we started out, people thought we were crazy doing the kind of music we're doing, because it was a short lifespan thing, but we've been able to do this for 10 years now. So yeah, some things obviously working. Do you want to add to that, Rich?
Yeah, I was going to say it's amazing to see the likes of Stephen Wilson and Opeth really blowing up over here in the UK. Stephen Wilson did 3 shows at the Albert Hall recently, mm-hmm. which is really unheard of for any prog band, really, apart from, say, David Gilmour or, I don't know, the Zappa Plays Zappa band. But it's quite rare for anyone to play at the Albert Hall, let alone 3 nights in a row. Mm-hmm. And then Opeth have recently played Wembley Arena. So all of these things really bode well for the whole scene. And you also mentioned Carnival. Mm-hmm. They do really well over here. They play the Roundhouse over in Camden. Yeah, we're all massive fans of those guys. Mm-hmm. And another guy from Australia, Pliny.
Yes.
He's blowing up all over the world, and he's an amazing guitar player. But it's great to see a lot of these forward-thinking musicians and bands really taking their music to different parts of the world.
Mm, absolutely. And you guys have been reasonably well received around the world, particularly here in Australia in prog scenes and such. Now, I did just want to bring you to one particular track on your new album, which is unashamedly my favourite track, which is Nil by Mouth. That is an absolute killer of a track. What was the genesis behind that? Because it's just such a... It reminds me of something you'd see on the Doom soundtrack. You know what I mean? It was such a great, just ball terror Blade, of a track.
Blade Trinity. You know the Blade film?
Yeah, absolutely.
A couple of scenes when he walks into a nightclub and there's like blood coming from the ceilings, and they're playing this crazy like tech-noir house music. Mm. So we kind of wanted to fuse that kind of sound with more industrial metal, so Fear Factory and Meshuggah. Mm-hmm. So the opening 3 minutes, we went for that really kind of hard-hitting riff sound, industrial riff sound. And they're probably the heaviest 2 minutes we've ever written. Mm-hmm. In Haken. It's just amazing to play that live. But generally, that didn't even start off as an instrumental track. We just, like with all songs, we'll just write them and see where it goes. But when we tried to pen some lyrics down for it, it just wasn't really working out. And it just didn't really make much sense. So we thought, why not? Let's just write an instrumental track. And that's how it came about, really.
Mm. So, Ross, this is your breather track then?
Yeah, I get to go backstage, have a cup of tea and relax for 6 minutes. And it's great. My favourite part of the set.
Put your feet up. So the overall feel of the new album is, you know, I mean, it's been extremely well received here in circles in Australia, and I would suggest probably around the world as well. I mean, I know you guys have hit charts in some certain countries with it. Tell us about the writing process. You sort of mentioned a little bit earlier there that you sort of just start writing and see where it goes. Is there any particular structure? You know, do you just walk into the studio with a riff and go, okay, I've got this, let's jam on it? Or, you know, do you guys do stuff at home and email it across to people and then put layers on it and such? How do you go about writing a new Haken song?
Well, this album is probably the most collaborative we've really ever been as a band. It all depends. A few of the songs started off with a couple of us just meeting, jamming through some ideas and seeing how they organically grow. And then usually we'll take those ideas back to our own personal studios and then start sharing stuff online, because we're all dotted around in different parts of the world. Connor's in Indiana, and Diego's in Mexico, and the rest of us are based around the UK. So we can't really always meet up and jam. Mm. So we had an online space, and we were just bouncing ideas back and forward for about 5 months with this album, which is definitely the most efficient we've ever been with the writing. But it's always different. So each song, we can't really follow a formula. So we'll just come up with an idea. Once we've got that key idea, we'll just see how it grows and just share it with the other guys and see where it goes.
Mm. I remember when we started out, we said to each other, all right, we want to make an album with killer riffs and like loads of vocal hooks. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the starting point, really. Like, right, that's the 2 points you need to bear in mind.
Yeah.
And lyrically, I mean, how do you guys, well Ross, I assume you write most of the lyrics. How do you go about your lyrics? Do you wait for the songs to be finished, or do you have poems that you write? Are you a poet at heart? And then you decide to see if you can sort of shoehorn them into a song structure.
So usually when we start the process, we kind of map out this overarching concept or set of themes that we want to touch on, and sometimes that can influence the music as well, so that really helps. But then lyrically speaking, we all tend to kind of go away and write our own pieces of poetry and try and attach these to certain parts of songs and it kind of comes together in a slow manner like that, piecing it together like a jigsaw, really. So, as long as we're all on the same page, and usually we end up finding a way to kind of craft that storyline or that set of themes in that way. I'd say, like, usually the music comes first, and we use those melodies to find the right words and diction and stuff like that. So.
And how do you guys deal with band disputes? So let's say you've got, Richard, you've come up with an absolutely amazing idea for a song, and you've sort of written out a basic structure of it, and then Ross, you come along and you say, no, I don't think this is actually going to work, and you chop and change. Do you just sort of go with the flow, or do you find sometimes that people sort of stand on their digs a bit? How do you resolve all of that? Is it just as simple as going down to the pub for a pint halfway through and then meeting up and chatting about it?
I think if we went to the pub and had a pint, it would probably just end up in tears. So I think it's a tricky one, because everyone's quite passionate about their own ideas, especially when it comes to being creative and you're expressing yourself. And I think the key is to really learn how to compromise. I feel that with the last two albums, we've been totally on that 100%, and everyone's embraced that whole spirit of compromising. I think sometimes you can compromise an idea way too much, to the point where it's so diluted it's just lost the original spirit of the first idea. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you just got to step back and say, okay, this is your vision, I guess. This is your idea. Let's just go with that and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. But other times you've got to step in and say, maybe I think this could be improved. And I don't feel we had any arguments with Vector. Maybe it's because we're, all not in the same room as each other. But
no, I think the album where we learned to deal with that the most is when we wrote The Mountain, because that was the first time we switched up from it being a Richard project to an actual band project, really, wasn't it? And so as soon as you start adding more creative egos to the pot, it does start to get trickier. But we learned how to deal with that, and I feel like it's working really smoothly now.
Beautiful. Now, this one is from Hoggy, so the other guy that does the podcast with me. He wants to know, if you were contractually obligated to play one song in every set for the rest of your career, what's the song?
Well, I'd say 1985, and I get to wear those glasses every night.
I'll go for Cockroach King. It's kind of covers all bases, really. It's got the kind of quirky stuff in there. It's also got the Meshuggah, Genty, heavy stuff as well. So, I'll go for that one.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we took a break from playing Cockroach King for the US tour.
Yeah.
But for me, that was actually quite a nice thing, because we had been playing every show since 2013. So.
Literally played every show.
Yeah. And then, so we took a break from putting that in our set. And then, for whatever reason, I think we had like a technical problem when we did the Denmark show this year, and we had to just whip out a different tune where we didn't need that piece of technology. So we put Cockroach King in. It was great fun to play, having had that break. It was nice to bring that back.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, last question. I'm aware that we're running out of time very quickly, so thank you for joining us on the 9-8 podcast, and I'm sure the listeners are very happy that you guys have managed to join us on this cold and blustery evening in Sydney. I don't know what it's like over in the UK. But last question, what's on your iPod at the moment? What are you guys listening to? What's in your Spotify playlists? What's something that you could give to me and say, you know what, have a listen to this, and this is what we're listening to?
Okay, two guys for me is Tigran Hamasyan, an Armenian jazz folk kind of guy. He's really interesting, so check that out. And Justin Vernon, specifically his project Volcano Choir, or Bon Iver, both of them, they're incredible.
I didn't know you had an iPod, Rich.
Yeah, I don't have an iPod. I've got a Spotify.
Yeah, I actually am old school. I do have an iPod. To be honest, I've just been trying to catch up with the recent releases, because we've been on tour a lot, and so we had obviously the Dream Theater album, the Neil Morse album, and various other stuff coming out. So yeah, I've just been kind of catch up on that stuff. But there was a new release I bought recently by a band called Uncle. It's spelled with a K. Mm-hmm. And they released kind of electronic, kind of alternative indie stuff. So they've dropped like a double concept album, which is really cool to do for like an indie band, you know. So that's something I've been listening to recently.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Ross, Richard, thank you so much for joining us this evening here, but today over in the UK. And you guys are hitting Australian shores and Kiwi shores, of course, in June. And I will be seeing you at the Sydney show. And I'm looking forward to what is going to be an amazing night.
We can't wait, man. Looking forward to it.
Nice one. Thank you so much for the interview. And let's see you there.
No worries. We'll catch you there.
Nice one. See you later.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
The 9-8 interview.
So there we have it, Ross and Richard from Haken. Thank you very much, Dave, for doing that interview. That was rather a good one.
Yeah, it was really good. It's always really nice when you get to sort of have a chat to some people who are just really nice people, and just talk music. And I think the podcast is a really different way of doing things in that it's a little bit more relaxed, you know. It's not it was only a 20-minute slot, but it wasn't
it was like a press. Was it a press day for the tour? Was that what it was? Yeah.
Yeah, basically. But I turned it a little bit around, as you heard. So I didn't just want to talk about the tour and the new album and things like that. I wanted to ask him some questions that we'd been actually talking about on the podcast. So hence the little things about economics of touring and such in there, because I just wanted some opinions from people who are actually on the road rather than two guys that are screaming into the ether.
And also as well, following up on our theory when we reviewed Haken's Vector a few months ago now, that we theorized that the record was maybe slightly influenced by the fact that several members of the band had spent 12 months playing Dream Theater songs with Mike Portnoy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That theory was turned out to be mostly correct.
Yeah, basically. And it's really interesting. I actually asked around to a few people that I knew as well. I was like, hey, I'm interviewing Haken tonight. Have you guys got any questions you want to ask me? Because I didn't just want to ask the same things, you know. And the top question I got from about five or six different people was, how much of the new album was influenced by playing The Shattered Fortress with Portnoy?
I dare say it's probably a question that they get, they would have gotten quite a bit.
I'd imagine
It was rather a high profile gig that they did.
Yes.
I imagine everyone would have been asking them, was it influenced? Was there an influence there? Their sound is quite influenced by Dream Theater in their own way anyway, so...
Mm-hmm.
The comparison is probably rather easy to make.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was. What I found really interesting about that as well was when they were talking about how they were writing, and they said because the guys don't all live in England, you know, there's some guys that live elsewhere in the world.
Oh, yeah. Connor's an American. He lives in America, I believe.
Yeah. And one of them is from Mexico as well. So they don't, they do most of their stuff online, but then on occasions they get into a room and they start jamming. And one of the things I thought that was really interesting was after it became more a band collaborative thing rather than Richard just writing a bunch of stuff and then saying, here's what I've written, now play, egos started to get involved and they had to learn how to deal with that, which I thought was a really, really interesting and sort of showed a little bit more of a human side of them, which I also thought was quite nice.
That's really interesting. I've heard other bands make references to like certain band members will push an idea that maybe not necessarily one that they wrote, but one that they really like, and then other band members will like try and bury it, try and bury the ideas, like, I don't like that one or something. And there's, an inevitable, there's like a certain amount of like horse trading that goes on. It's like, okay, all right, we'll have this bit. Okay, you like this bit, cool, we'll put that on the record, but only if you agree to have the other bit that I like that you don't like,
Exactly.
So, so you end up with a record, that maybe not everybody likes everything that went on the record.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that happens across bands across the world.
This is probably, I imagine, relatively universal.
Absolutely it is. But enough about that. I think we've kept the good people waiting long enough. I think we need to dive into our main topic, my friend.
Yes, we do. So Jordan Rudess, Wired for Madness.
Oh yeah, what?
So let's get the fun parts out of the way. I'm not going to ask you, did you like this record? Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you, how much did you like this record?
On a scale of 1 to we'll never stop listening to it ever again, I'd say it's just under the we'll never stop listening to it again. It was really, really cool. There was so many influences in here, and there were parts of the album where I'm like, shit, that sounds like Erotomania, or that sounds like, you know, tracks from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and yeah, obviously with
the
Jordan.
ELP influence should not be underplayed on this record. There is a lot of ELP sounding things on the record. I mean, everybody wants to talk about the keyboard playing. Yes, that's definitely. Keith Emerson is one of Jordan's biggest influences, but I would also say with his vocals as well. His vocals sound a hell of a lot like Greg Lake.
Oh yeah,
there's
massive.
A lot of Greg Lake in there.
Massive, and the whole album is just brilliant. And I've got to say, Jordan's actually got a really good voice.
He did sing. He hasn't sung on a lot of his records. A lot of his records, he's either had people do the singing for him, or it's been purely instrumental.
Yes.
He did sing on his first record, which, I think he copped a lot of flack in like magazines and just dickheads reviewing him saying, oh, his voice is shit. Yeah, and maybe that stopped him for a while. But now I think his voice is really, really good.
Yeah, but I
probably
think
influenced as well by the Bark to Rock tour where he did a lot of singing. He covered King Crimson stuff with Greg. I mean, a Greg Lake penned tune of King Crimson.
Yes.
He covered David Bowie. What else did he sing? I think it was just those two, wasn't it?
Yeah, he did. He just did some. I think as well as that, not just the singing, but being the front man, I suppose, if you want to put that in inverted quotes, on that tour as well, because it was just him and a piano, right? Oh, and his Geo Shred thing. But realistically, it was just him and a piano. And it was a very different way of doing things for him, I would suggest.
Absolutely. He's opened gigs. Mm-hmm. Doing this kind of show, not singing, but just playing. He opened for Blackfield across America for a while. Yes. Like him and a piano.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think it is quite critical to state in here as well that Jordan's confidence as a quote-unquote frontman has clearly gone through the roof in the last
100%.
I think, honestly, since Portnoy left. Because that's when, realistically, they started having to do a lot more of the media stuff.
Yes.
As well as that with social media and all that taking off as well. You can see his confidence having risen, and not just having to be confident behind the piano, but also being confident in interviews, confident in just chatting with people. And we got that vibe at the From Bark to Rock tour as well.
Oh, yeah,
when
absolutely.
He came out and we chatted with him afterwards, it wasn't a case of, oh, hi, I'm Jordan, blah, blah, blah. It was, hey, thanks so much for coming. You know, he was obviously tired, but it was very much just
a day like that.
Good conversation, you know. And then someone came down and said, hey, there's a couple of guys here from the Dream Theater fan club. Can you meet them? And he looked at us and we went, well, yeah, I mean, we're here, but there's probably some other people outside as well. And he went, cool, let's go and meet them, you know. And it wasn't an idea of someone who's a very sort of inward, sort of a recluse, if you will, which a lot of people with Jordan's ability, with Jordan's prowess, probably would be.
Oh, totally. Totally.
He's not like that. And I think this album really shows that. The other thing this album does as well is the second you turn it on, it is unmistakably Jordan Rudess.
Yep.
You hear it and you go, that's Jordan Rudess. You just know it. You know what I
There's
mean?
There's a style, the way the keyboard, like the keyboard sounds, the way he's playing it, the arrangement is 100% Jordan.
Absolutely.
Straight up.
There is one thing, though, that I really want to know, and I suspect I'll probably never get the answer to it.
You never know.
I don't think Petrucci used his signature Music Man on this album. I think he used the Ibanez.
I'll put that in the back of my mind, and if I ever get the chance to talk to him when I'm in Bulgaria, I'll ask him.
Have a listen, because they sound.
I couldn't pick one guitar from the other. I'm not that much of a gear head necessarily.
It sounds.
you're way more closer to that than I am.
It sounds literally. I heard it and went, that doesn't sound like a Music Man. That sounds like an Ibanez. Like it sounds. It's got that woody. Typical Ibanez sound to it, and that particular model that he had a very unique sound to it. And I've heard it and went, that doesn't sound like a Music Man. I might be wrong. I might be completely wrong. I might be just, maybe John used something a little bit different this time. Maybe he was running through a different amplifier or something. Genuinely, I don't know. But if I had to pick something, I reckon it's that he's using the Ibanez, the P1, P2, P3s instead of the JPM models, instead of the Music Mans. That's what I think.
You'll have to write that one down on a bit of paper for me so I can ask him, Dave.
Because yeah, absolutely.
I will never remember that in a million years.
Yeah. Well, if I get the opportunity to interview him when they announce the tour, I might ask him myself. Quietly, I hope I don't interview Petrucci again. I'd really like to interview Myung or Labrie so I can cross one of them off the list.
the likelihood of getting John Myung to do an interview is pretty much nil.
We will see.
James, you might get. That could happen.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking that I'm probably going to have an earlier chance to interview the band than you, though. We'll have to cut this bit because I'm trying to nail one of them down to interview in Bulgaria.
Although
That's right in the middle of like a whirlwind tour for them because they're flying they fly in from a festival, do the show, and then fly back out again the following day to do a festival. So we'll see.
We'll see. Maybe maybe you can get in contact with the festival organisers and see if you can get yourself a media pass. But I've got to ask you, what's the standout for you on this album?
Ooh, that is such a hard question. I mean, you would think that I would be up for the sort of big long track, the Wired for Madness, which is interesting. On the album, it's split into two parts, I think.
Two parts in that there's part one and part two, but all of those parts are actually split up as well. So you've got Wired for Madness 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, and then 2.1 through 2.7.
Okay, I have a question. Why do it that way? Why not have one track? Too much to skip around, or
good question. I suspect, knowing Jordan, he probably wrote a whole bunch of different things and then found a way to hem them together. So,
okay, you may have thought that I would have enjoyed the really widdly widdly stuff, but I really enjoy the sort of just piano and voice, that kind of stuff. But I mean, on the Bach to Rock tour, I really enjoyed his version of "I Talk to the Wind," the King Crimson song. That is a beautiful arrangement, really, really nice. And the song "Why I Dream" sort of feels a bit in that same way. Just simple piano, voice, some choir and strings type things, but mostly that.
Yeah.
And then there's the other one that I'd like to call out as well, which is Just Can't Win, which sounds like what I imagine Jordan would do if he was going to write something for a big band arrangements. There's jazzy, there's horns, there's all sorts of things going on. Yeah. Those two I particularly enjoy from the sort of non-prog sphere, because those are the things we see a lot of Jordan when he's playing in Dream Theater, all the really technical stuff, but there's another side to him that we just don't see with Dream Theater.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, if you look at the list of people that he collaborated with on this album, obviously you've got John Petrucci, right? Anything that he does is always going to be talking about, you know, you're going to have John or you're going to have someone from Dream Theater there helping him out and so on and so forth. But you talk about big band and bluesy sort of stuff. I mean, he collaborated with Joe Bonamassa as well. So
yep, he sure did.
You know,
did and Rod Guthrie Morgenstern Govan, play drums on this record? Did Rod Morgenstern? Usually, Rod's playing something on his solo records. That's usually how it works.
Remarkable question. I've got a sneaking suspicion he did, but I need to double check that. I'm not sure, but I know Guthrie Govan played on this as well. So, you know, it really is basically Jordan and friends.
James Labrie is on this record too, by the way.
Yes, yeah. But the whole album is just. What's amazing about this album is, yes, you've got the big epic Wired for Madness song, right? But you've got all the other ones as well, which really showcase a lot of his influences and a lot of his early stuff. And it sort of really feels like to me, now having heard this album, that the whole Bach to Rock thing was kind of almost a forerunner to what this album is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know? And it, not in it, a bad
I
way.
I think... Oh, absolutely. It would have been cool, although he never would have been able to do it at the same scale. Because, and I suspect, and this is my theory. That tour, that Bach to Rock tour, was what he was originally planning to have for The Wired for Madness, like if he was going to quote-unquote tour that album. But he couldn't tour the album because it was going to come out after the Dream Theater record and they were going to tour that.
That's a really good, really so good
my theory is that
summation, yeah.
You know, portions of that record could or should have been played live as like a tour of that album, but he couldn't do that because the album was going to come out after the Dream Theater record.
Mm.
And he was kind of, okay, I can't do what I want. But, but I could do this other thing. And it's just like me and the piano.
Mm.
Me, the piano, and then his iPad.
Well, it's a good summation. I think it's
it would have been awesome,
a-
actually, if he did the iPad and the piano at the same time. You know, like piano, but he couldn't, bit difficult to rig up a iPad to sit on top of a Steinway grand piano.
Well, yes, it's a little bit difficult.
And probably, you're not going to put that iPad on that Steinway, you'll scratch crap out of it.
Yeah, exactly. You can just imagine all the people in the opera house going, I'm sorry, what are you doing? but look, overall, Wired for Madness, I would say go and order it, go and buy it.
It's out now, so you can definitely buy it. It came out on the 19th of April, 2019. Yes. We're recording this on the Monday afterwards.
Yes. but it's a fantastic album, and it really showcases Jordan's ability, not just as the pianist for Dream Theater, the keyboardist for Dream Theater, and not just as the wizard and all that sort of stuff, but as an overall musician.
Absolutely.
And I think the title of it, the album as well, really captures it, Wired for Madness, because this album is absolutely mad.
Absolutely. The other thing that we haven't spoken about yet, but I think we probably should, is his lyrics.
Yeah.
What do you think of those?
Very introspective.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I like. Very much like.
I still can't work out why he hasn't done lyrics for Dream Theater.
I suspect possibly for the same reason that it took Myung years and years to bring it back. They probably require too much work to actually shoehorn into the Dream Theater stuff.
Yeah. With the melodies and stuff. Maybe the sort of melodies that Jordan wants to write, James can't sing, because obviously Jordan's voice is much lower.
Yes.
Potentially, maybe, possibly. Or you're right, it's kind of like, these lyrics don't really fit with the Dream Theater sound or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think this is a big thing.
Well, I think maybe, because I remember Jordan told a story when he came into the band with Scenes from Memory, he brought in a whole bunch of ideas for the record and it was like, have a listen to this. And Mike and John essentially sat there and went, oh, that's cool. Put that in your solo album. Or no, that'll never make a Dream Theater record. Oh no, we'll have that one. So I think he was like, oh, okay, maybe some of those ideas kind of sits back from in the band because there are,
yeah, I think that's definitely plausible.
Another theory: lyricists being or vocalists being vocalists only want to sing stuff they can like feel. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So maybe possibly James is like, I don't quite, I don't feel this lyric necessarily.
It's cool lyric
and works for the music or something, but no, maybe not.
Mm. And I think this is a critical thing that a lot of vocalists around the world, I think, need to understand is that there is a brand, right? So if you're in a band or you're in a solo project or something like that, if you would never see, for example, Limp Bizkit take the lyrics from a Britney Spears song and do it.
The example that I was thinking of in my head was that you wouldn't have Rush, say, do a lyric that sounds like a Motley Crue song.
Correct.
Chicks, party, rock and roll sort of. That's not
exactly
that's not the Rush sound.
Exactly.
There tends to be, it's either like a sci-fi thing or very introspective.
Exactly. And it's not.
Mind you, though, Dream Theater's not immune or opposed to introspection. That's definitely happened on a whole bunch of lyrics.
Of course. But the interesting thing about introspection with Dream Theater is that it is never unique to a specific person, right? So take, for example, The Best of Times, right?
Mm.
Which is universally acknowledged for some reason as one of the best Dream Theater sort of those sorts of songs, where you're talking about past lives and, things that are going on in your life and all that sort of stuff. If you look at that song, you look at The Best of Times, right? It's written in such a way, it's not, Mike Portnoy and his dad, and this is what happened, and boo-hoo. It is, okay, this is something that's affecting a lot of people. This is something that's affecting a lot of people, and a lot of people can relate to it. That Dream Theater have a very unique way of writing in that they could be, and all lyricists will be able to do this, but they can take a very personal topic and actually extrapolate that to appeal to a mass market. And that is something that's very difficult to do. I was actually talking
one lyric that I think that now that you've mentioned it, one lyric that another lyric that I think they did that particularly well with Panic Attack.
Oh, dude, Panic Attack, yes,
yeah. They've done that. They did that very, very well with Panic Attack.
Yep, and
never,
Vacant.
Never Enough as well. Actually, to be perfectly honest, yep. Those two, Panic Attack and Never Enough.
Yep, Never Enough. Vacant.
Yes.
You know, this is what I'm saying. They have this unique way of writing, which is not, I went to this and then this happened to me. It's not a selfish sort of look on it, although it is coming from a place of that. You know, it's very much it's on brand for Dream Theater in that it's applicable to so many different people. And I think Jordan writes somewhat in that way, only I think probably he's a little bit too introspective in that it's sort of about his experience, and some of his experiences are not quite as relatable as some of the other experiences. So I suspect that's possible one of the reasons that his lyrics haven't made it onto a Dream Theater album yet.
Fair enough.
I could be wrong, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, but...
Oh, yeah. These are all questions which I don't think we probably ever would get an answer.
Mm.
The other thing to note as well is that Jordan does play a bit of guitar on this record.
Yeah.
He's openly acknowledged it in a few Q&As. It's like,
well, he got a signature guitar from some chap. I can't remember who it was, but he got a signature guitar.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I know there's footage on the internet that exists of him playing guitar at that Liquid Tension Experiment gig.
Yes.
Where his keyboard's crapped out and then he came out eventually and started playing guitar.
Yes.
He took John's guitar for that one. He didn't have his own back then, but he took John's guitar and started playing.
Just a bit of a real-time follow-up. It's called the Drazkowski Wizard Guitar, and it's a headless design by Drazkowski Guitars. It's an 8-string.
So it looks a bit like a Steinberger?
Kind of, yeah, but a little bit more pointy, and it's an 8-string.
An 8-string?
Correct.
Oh, okay. That is interesting.
Really quickly for you guitar nerds out there, it's a neck through construction, 13-piece neck. 13-piece neck, really? An ebony fretboard, multi-scale, so 26 to 27 inches, with swamp ash wings, mahogany tone block under the pickups, bare knuckle pickups with a 5-way selector switch, and custom inlays and a servo selector as well. So for those of you who know what all that means, and those of you who don't, you can ask us in the comment section. We don't mind.
I was going to say, and in the words of John Oliver, cool.
Yep. So look, new album from Jordan Rudess, Wired for Madness. What's your overall feeling on the album? Two thumbs up, two thumbs down? I mean, stupid question.
Two thumbs up.
Yeah.
It's really, really – I'll say the same thing about this album I said about Devin Townsend's album. Is this going to be my album of 2019? No.
No.
You know, Distance Over Time still sits on top of that tree, but it's still a fantastic record and people should go and buy it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It'll be, I suspect this will probably be in my top five.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, but that's our album review, I think, of the new, Jordan Rudess album and our chat about it. But we've still got a couple of album reviews to do.
Yes, we do. Now we move on to the ones that we give each other. You gave me Memphis Mayfire's Broken.
I did.
Why? Actually, no. You may expect me to shit on this record heavily, and I might get to that a bit later. But I was listening to the lead-off track for this album, and I'm like, why does this sound familiar? Why does this sound familiar? And then it hit me. This song kind of sounds like Dream Theater's Paralyzed.
Just a bit.
Just a little fucking bit.
Yep.
And I was like, hang on a minute. Why does this sound familiar? It's almost the same song structure.
Almost.
Okay. And the vocal melody, I mean, maybe I'm sort of extrapolating a bit too far here, but the melody in the verses kind of sounds the same.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
The chorus is completely different, but the way that the verses are constructed, it was like, where have I heard this song before? And then it hit me, bang. Oh, yeah, that's like Dream Theater's Paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the album just sounded like so many other metal bands, it's not even funny.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a... They're a generic metal band.
I was going to say, it just sounds like, oh, I've heard this band. Haven't I heard this band before? Yeah. I feel this way. I mean, this sounds incredibly snobby, and I sound like a total jaded asshole when I say it, but...
Yeah, snobby prog.
I have...
No.
Yeah. Prog snob. Ha ha. But I have this problem with so much of this kind of metal and a lot of the stuff. I mean, the only time that I hear modern pop radio is when I'm in a taxi going to an airport.
Yes.
Because that's the only, I mean, and I just hear, and it all just sounds, it's like you have male pop singer and you have female pop singer.
Yes.
And the only way I know who is who is sometimes the Uber drivers have the, like, you know, have radio stations put it out through the thing, like who's playing the song. They'll have the title and the artist. That's the only way I'm able to differentiate any of them. I would like to walk back from this, but my original thought was, oh, this sounds like Parkway Drive, but it doesn't really sound like Parkway Drive, actually. I walked myself back from that one once I had another listen to Parkway Drive, and I'm like, no, that doesn't really sound like Parkway Drive, actually. That's kind of mean.
I'm very glad that you walked back from that, because I would have smacked you down very hard.
It sounds like so many, like this album sounds like so many other metal bands, but I couldn't name any of them at all.
I have to say that we do, if there's one thing that Australia does very well, it's that whole screamo metalcore sort of Parkway Drive, you know, Polaris, all that sort of stuff. We really are leading the world in that sort of genre. No idea how we've managed to do that, but we do.
I'm just wondering whether it's not the influence of those traditional Australian pub rock bands, people who, like these guys who grew up listening to, I'm assuming, AC/DC, Cold Chisel, Grinspoon, okay, not really pub rock, but Grinspoon, Powderfinger, Silverchair, and then they've gone a step further with that. Like all the guys in America who grew up listening to the big four of thrash, and then that got, and then that became like Lamb of God, Killswitch Engage, etc.
Yeah, possible. I mean, It is plausible that is the way that it's happened, but I genuinely don't know. I just don't know how it is that we've managed to be the kings of that for quite some time. It's not like it's been, you know, a week or two. Like we've been
I'm going to pin it down to the influence of AC/DC. That's my theory.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my the AC/DC and like a mix of those other three that I mentioned: Powderfinger, Grinspoon, and Silverchair. Because they were all sort of around at about the same time. Okay, Silverchair was a bit later, and Grinspoon was a bit later, and Powderfinger was a bit earlier. But
yeah,
they're all sort of around about the same time.
Yeah. Well, definitely.
So yeah, my review of this album is going to be very short, because I don't really have anything to say beyond the first. It's like the first song kind of sounded like Paralyzed, the rest of them. And then there were two songs at the very end that were kind of like the ballady sort of versions, which kind of sound weird from a band that have just spent the whole album doing that sort of, you know, new metal, punk metal sort of thing. And then they have two ballads at the end of the record. Yeah. That's kind of weird. But
well, I think this is definitely something that we need to highlight on the show as well. If you are going to throw in ballads and all that sort of stuff, and when you're writing an album, you're going to do an album, et cetera. And we've already heard my opinions on doing albums in today's day and age. But if you are going to do it, for God's sake, make it sure it's balanced. Right, don't spend 10 tracks doing sort of stuff. Not that that's what this album was. It was more a little more whiny than that, to be honest with you. But then don't just throw two ballads in at the end. Like, you put it through the album, you know what I mean? Like, it's anyway, that's
the pace. It's like it's like constructing an album is like constructing a set list.
Exactly.
You do that what do they call it? It's like the W thing.
Yes.
You start up top with a really high energy song, and then you slowly bring it down, do a couple of ballads in the middle, then come up again for a bit, and then come back down again, and then finish high.
Correct.
I think an album kind of has to be the same way.
Of course it does.
It's certainly how it used to be with vinyl. That's how bands like Rush and stuff and Black Sabbath and all thought of albums that have of vinyl that way. It's kind of like two sets.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, you have the lead-off track, then you have the single, then you have the ballad, then you have a closing for side one, and then side two is kind of the same thing again.
I agree, yeah.
Maybe with a few less songs, you know, if you've got an eight tracks or six or whatever you've got, you know.
And I agree.
Yeah, that's my, I don't really have much more else to say about that album, but the album that I gave you, Big Big Train's Folklore. Yes. What'd you think?
Yeah, Big Big Train, Marillion want their sound back. I'm not suggesting
that's kind of mean.
Well, not really. I actually really enjoyed it. Like but literally from the opening track, which is Folklore, I went, well, this sounds like this Strange Engine. Like the whole album is brilliant. Don't get me wrong. Particularly, and I want to call one track out here, The Transit of Venus Across the Sun, not just because it's an amazing track title, but because it's just a brilliant song.
Yeah, that one's my favorite as well.
I really like it. This album, I'm not going to really say too much about it, except for the fact that it does sound very Marillion. It's a very British,
there's a lot of
prog
that modern
sound.
Yeah, modern, I think they call it neo-prog. I think that's the label that kind of gets slapped over the top of bands.
Yes.
Like Marillion, like IQ, Pendragon, those kind of bands kind of get slapped with this neo-prog label.
Yep.
Porcupine Tree sort of fell into that as well up until they signed with Roadrunner and went metal.
Yes.
You know what I think of music labels, but well, this one seemed,
But no, I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't change it. That's for sure. I very, very much enjoyed Folklore. And you can actually download the entire discography as well at the moment for next to nothing, or you can just buy this digital album for £6, which is about $12. So definitely,
I think
get
it's
on
like
that.
in the run up to their album, their new album coming out, which is out in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. It's out in the middle of May. They're doing a big run on where you can purchase their entire discography for 20% off.
Yeah,
and there's quite a bit there too. So,
and I will mention as well, for the few people that are listening in from the UK, and there are a couple of people listening in from the UK, they are doing a couple of shows in October. So if you do want to go and check that out, you can definitely do that. But for me, two thumbs up. Big Big Train's Folklore was brilliant.
So what have you got for me this week, Dave?
Oh, I got a new release for you, my friend.
Boy.
So there's a band called Jam Carrot, that's spelled DJAMKRET. I hope I'm spelling it right. But these guys have been around since 1984. But they just released a brand new album. And I say just released as in probably 3 or 4 days ago. And the album is called A Sky Full of Stars for a Roof. Now, these guys are instrumental, progressive, electronica kind of stuff. You can listen to it on Spotify, or you can buy it from their Bandcamp as well. The digital album, I think, is $12 US. These guys are from California. Highly recommend this album for you. I think you're going to really enjoy it. So definitely get on that one and have a listen. So it's Jam Carrot's A Sky Full of Stars for a Roof.
Fantastic. Okay, I took a little bit of time for me to try and find it, but I found it.
That's all right. And what have you got for me?
So the album that I have for you comes courtesy of my fiancée. She turned me onto a band called Tiamat, and the album that I'm going to pick for you is probably their seminal record called Wild Honey from 1994.
Okay.
This is available on Spotify, so I'm not going to stitch you up like I did last time. The only problem with this is that this version on Spotify has a couple of the studio tracks performed live for some odd reason, you get the idea.
Yeah.
So, Tiamat, Wild Honey from 1994.
Okay. Be interesting, because the only thing I know about Tiamat is pretty sure Tiamat is one of the eons you can get in Final Fantasy X. And I,
you're on your own with that one. I never played a Final Fantasy game.
And I know that it's a goddess in Dungeons and Dragons, I'm pretty sure. And I'm
it's a primordial goddess of the salt sea from Greek mythology, I think.
Right. Okay. That'd be Abzu, I think, would be the counterpart to that.
Yes, that's the god of freshwater.
There you go. So, yeah, so Tiamat.
Somebody remembers their Greek mythology.
No, I just play a lot of video games and it gets referenced.
Fair enough.
Nerd, what? So there we have it. So I think that about wraps it up for this week. And thank you guys for listening in once again to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground here in Australia. Now, next week, we are going to have a really, really cool interview. The Omnific, who I have mentioned a couple of times on this podcast, are hitting the road. And in celebration of them hitting the road, they actually found the time to sit down and have a quick chat with me regarding their tour and their new album. So stay tuned for that one. Yep. But other than that, thank you so much for listening. My name is David Ellis.
And my name is Alex Hogg. We shall see you all next time.
Catch you then.
Catch ya.